Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Welcome to the CURE panel. This is the entire CURE Talk team here, Sharif Khan, Priya Menon, and Chintan Patel. And we're very excited to kick off our inaugural series of CURE panel, which is a talk show that we are kicking off to bring in leading experts in the field, bloggers, patients, family members, caregivers, to have meaningful discussions about the latest treatments and developments in a particular disease area. And we start off today with a myeloma CURE panel that we have put together, which is going to be very fascinating, and we are hoping for a very lively discussion for the next 60 minutes. Our expert today will be Dr. Ravi Vij. He is an associate professor of medicine at the University of Washington, Washington University School of Medicine, St. Louis. And Dr. Vij's research focus is the treatment of hematological malignancies and stem cell transplant. And he'll be discussing the latest in myeloma treatments, and we'll be answering questions from a panel. I'll let Priya, scientific editor at the CURE Talk blog, introduce our panelists, and then we'll quickly get into a brief Q&A with Dr. Vij about the latest developments in multiple myeloma, and then have our panelists take on from there, asking their questions of interest. So Priya, would you like to take it out from here?
Thank you, Sharif. Everyone, let me just introduce you to all the panelists we have here. We have Pat Billingsworth, who is a noted medical writer, blogger, and myeloma patient. We have Nick Van Dyck, myeloma survivor and musician. Laurie Pionte, myeloma caregiver to husband Dave, editor of MyelomaSurvival.com, Gary Peterson, myeloma survivor and blogger Karen Crowley, guest blogger Jennifer Myers, and clinical trials and nonprofit management expert Kimberly Blossom. Before we go further, I'll just read out a couple of rules for you that will make it easier for us to have enjoy this discussion. We strongly recommend that if you happen to listen to this on your computer and you've simultaneously dialed in through the phone, please mute or stop the online broadcast as we pause an echo in the phone line. We'll request to all panelists to stay within the time limit allotted. We will give you a gentle reminder, and this will help you to wrap up your section. Listeners who have been invited can ask in questions in the end. They can do so by pressing 1 while on call, and based on the time available, we will bring them online.
Thanks so much, Priya. So once again, if people have, we will try to bring in listeners towards the end of the show. And they can ask their questions by pressing 1, and we'll try to accommodate as many number of people. So we'll get Dr. Vij online on air now. And Dr. Vij, good afternoon. Hope you're having a wonderful day. So it would be great if you could introduce yourself to the listeners today, and then we'll pick it up from there and have a quick Q&A with you.
Thank you. So I'm an associate professor in the section of stem cell transplant and hematological malignancies at Washington University School of Medicine. As introduced, I have look after a broad set of hematological malignancies, but my research focus is certainly in multiple myeloma. And we've certainly had a lot of good new drugs to work with, and I'll be glad to, you know, take the questions as they come.
Thank you, Dr. Vij. So we have several questions lined up for you, and I think we'll just get started quickly. So, Dr. Vij, can you give us a quick 5-minute recap of what's happened in the multiple myeloma landscape in the last 10 years, and what are the three most important developments that have had an impact on survival rates, have had an impact on quality of life of patients once they've been diagnosed with multiple myeloma? So if you really summarize the landscape in the last 10 to 15 years, how things have changed and how things have developed, and where we are today compared to 15 years ago, that will set a good context for all the listeners today, and then we can take it on from there as to what's going to happen in the next 5 to 10 years in the multiple myeloma landscape.
I think that a lot has happened, and it's very difficult to choose the three most important developments. I think that this is one disease where our other colleagues in other areas of oncology are actually somewhat envious of us because of the kind of impact we're making. Advances span the spectrum from a better understanding of the basic biology of the disease to better interventions in terms of treatments. I think that we are entering an era where we will hopefully risk stratify patients for more therapies that they are more likely to respond to. However, going and looking back in the last 10 years, I think the introduction of two classes of drugs, proteasome inhibitors and immunomodulatory drugs, namely bortezomib and lenalidomide, and before that, thalidomide, has impacted the landscape of treatment like never before. I think if you were to put it in perspective, the first major advance in the therapeutics for myeloma occurred in the early 60s when survival rates went from 18 months to 2.5 to 3 years with the introduction of melphalan and prednisone. The next major advance came in the 90s with the introduction of stem cell transplant as a therapeutic measure, which in most trials added a further 24 months to an individual's lifespan, and people talked about lifespans being 5 to 6 years for patients with myeloma. And now with the advent of the new drugs, I think most people are comfortable putting an average life expectancy of 7 to 8 years. And I think that certainly we are only getting better with the newer drugs that are in the pipeline. Carfilzomib just got approved. Pomalidomide is expected to be approved next year. There are a number of other drugs that also look promising in development, including monoclonal antibodies like elotuzumab, the histone deacetylase inhibitors, maybe possibly in addition to our armamentarium in the future. And so the advances are, I think, going to just continue. And I think that obviously the goal is to cure the disease. And in fact, some people have actually now started talking about the fact that that is within reach. I think that there are certainly some people that have been cured with myeloma with allogeneic transplantation in the past. But now there is more emerging data that with the newer drugs and with in the paradigm, 10% of people who enter a complete remission may be in remission 12 years to 15 years out and possibly may be cured, though autologous transplant is still not presented as a curative modality and is not curative for most. There may be a subset where perhaps it is doing so, but I think that before we have that level of optimism, we do need to, I think, get a little more data. But we have data from more than one group now, a couple of groups that is suggesting that there may be some people that we really may have put the disease into perhaps a permanent remission. So I think that it has been a great 10 years, but I think the 10 years to come will probably be even greater as the fruits of the genomic efforts and other research efforts start paying off. As I said, initially perhaps in risk stratification and choosing our therapies, but ultimately having these technologies develop targets for actually new drug development that will lead to even better therapeutics to come.
So Dr. Wade, that's really exciting news. I mean, personally have been reading up and following up on the developments in the multiple myeloma landscape. So you mentioned a few drugs that are in the pipeline. Could you elaborate a little bit upon these drugs that are coming in the next 3 to 5 years? And then I want to follow up with that, how these drugs are different from the ones that have already been developed. So we can get a better understanding of how they work and why they are so more promising and why they are advancing from the current state of the art. So can you give us the details about the three drugs that you mentioned that are likely to be in the pipeline for the next 3 to 5 years?
So I think that the one that is already probably out of the pipeline is carfilzomib, which I think is a drug that is expected to be of further benefit over and above what bortezomib, the first proteasome inhibitor on the market, provided. Mm-hmm. This is a drug that is, at least in the laboratory, able to overcome bortezomib resistance. It is a drug that is what we call an irreversible proteasome inhibitor and shuts off the proteasome nearly completely, irreversibly, and could therefore be accounting for its better effectiveness. The issue about the drug is that it is currently approved for people who have seen bortezomib and lenalidomide and are relapsed and refractory to their most recent line of therapy. And I think that it certainly will be used in that space, but I think that it will also perhaps be given to patients if theirs are collaborative to even people that are perhaps not really truly refractory to bortezomib and may actually be a better drug in terms of its efficacy. The data from the licensing study suggested a 19% response rate in people who were refractory to bortezomib as their last line of therapy. For a single agent to have that kind of activity in a bortezomib refractory population, which often got bortezomib in two or three drug combinations just before going on to a single agent on trial, is, I think, fairly meritorious. In patients who had failed both lenalidomide and bortezomib, the response rates were 15%. Now, in the real world, I think most people are going to use it in combination at least with dexamethasone and perhaps even with third agents like lenalidomide. And we know that the more drugs you add to the mix, you're going to see better response rates and better complete remission rates. So I think that 19% is probably going to go fairly higher. We know that with the experience to date with combination therapy with carfilzomib, revlimid, and decadron, and the response rates were reported to be over 70%. And these were patients often that had actually become refractory to lenalidomide and bortezomib. So I think that we have enough proof of the drug being, I think, active in a bortezomib refractory population at the current doses. Mm-hmm. In fact, doses higher than what are currently licensed are being tried, and one is hopeful that one may see even greater activity at the higher doses. However, one needs to have a little more data to say that that is conclusively true. The side effect profile of the drug also is very favorable, that in that near absence of neuropathy signal, which has plagued a lot of patients who have been on bortezomib. The drug could therefore be administered hopefully for longer periods of time than bortezomib has been in the past, and that will hopefully mean that longer-lived remissions and hopefully even better survival. One thing to watch out with the drug is that there is about one-third of patients that complain of shortness of breath, and I think that is something that is important to be aware about, because, yes, patients will often call in with shortness of breath the day of or the day after the administration of the drug, and to be honest, it's still not completely clear as to what the etiology behind the shortness of breath is. Most people do not feel that it is truly a cardiac toxic event, but may be related to the fluid load that is given with the drug. So some people have postulated giving less fluid with the drug may be helpful, especially in older individuals that may have a compromised cardiac function, a heart function. Others have thought that it's due to chemical release, what we call cytokine release from the drug that makes the blood vessels in the lung leaky, and that these are transient episodes that then just settle. The other is that there could be possibly what we call pulmonary artery hypertension. That is, it causes the blood vessels in the big blood vessels that supply the lungs to constrict and raise the pressure on the right side of the heart. But these are all postulates. The good thing is, in most cases, it is fairly mild and usually does not require any intervention. But I think that because the drug is new, both treating physicians and patients will probably have a learning curve on this issue. So I think that going forth, the drug is certainly moving into combination therapies. It is going to be moving into upfront treatment of myeloma. But I think till the FDA registers the drug for frontline use, possibly the frontline use of the drug may be somewhat limited at the moment for a few years at least, because there is greater oversight by third-party payers of off-label use in the frontline setting. Bortezomib use in frontline setting didn't take off in a major way, at least still. It got the FDA label in that line of use. So I think that the drug already has proved its merit in frontline use with at least two or three now studies combining it with a variety of agents. So I think that is, I think, a drug that hopefully will continue to be developed with even better results to come. Pomalidomide is before the FDA and is expected to have a ruling by, I believe, February of 2013. Most people, at least in the treatment community, are pretty, you know, impressed with the drug's activity in a, what we call a dual refractory population of bortezomib with lenalidomide-based therapy, where response rates of 30% again have been seen. But need to be clear that this 30% response rate is when pomalidomide is combined with dexamethasone. So people tend to compare the results, and even people who are treating sometimes miss the fact that the carfilzomib response rate in a dual refractory population of 15% was single agent carfilzomib. When you have the 30% response rate with pomalidomide, that is with pomalidomide and dex. So you have, and pomalidomide alone has a response rate of about 9%. So the drug, almost certainly when it is used, has to be given with dexamethasone once approved. So I think that that drug continues to be developed and will hopefully provide even more options to come. The third drug that I'm most excited about also is elotuzumab, which is a monoclonal antibody to this antigen called CS1, which is present on myeloma cells and a host of immune cells.
Could you repeat the name of this, the third drug that you just mentioned, the
elotuzumab, E-L-O-T as in Tom, U-Z-U-M-A-B. And that drug is a drug that actually was nearly given up upon a few years ago because when used as a single agent, it had zero activity, no activity at all. And it actually, when combined with lenalidomide, has an activity of in a lenalidomide naive population of over 90%. In a population where you would expect lenalidomide and dex to have much less activity on their own. So lenalidomide dex in the registration trials for the drug done in a fairly similar population. It's always a fallacy to compare across trials, but I think that the data there was about a 60% response rate with using much higher doses of dexamethasone like we used to do in the past, 4 days on, 4 days off. Here, with just using once-weekly dexamethasone with the Revlimid, the response rates are 90% plus. So there is a clear signal that the drug is probably doing something. And obviously, phase three trials, both in the relapse refractory and upfront setting called the Eloquent 2 and the Eloquent 1 trials, are currently ongoing. And one of the things that the physician community has been most excited about is the durability of responses that seems to be with this drug very long lasting in quite a subset of the patients. And I think that that is one thing that at least made me reevaluate my own thinking. I used to think that when drugs don't have single agent activity, giving them in combination perhaps doesn't make that much logical sense, and that you are wasting patient and other resources for clinical trials to perhaps develop other drugs that have single agent activity. But I think that as long as you have some convincing activity in phase two studies that you may be seeing a clear-cut signal of improvement, then phase three trials are warranted, and hopefully this drug will you know, keep that paradigm alive. Also, I think I will add what we call histone deacetylase inhibitors, the first of which, vorinostat, was a trial that was reported at the American Society of Hematology meeting in December of 2011, and that trial showed about 30% or so response rate. But the benefit, though it was claimed the trial met its primary endpoint, was relatively modest in that the improvement in progression-free survival, as we call it, was less than a month. So though statistically significant, people thought that was not clinically really probably that relevant. However, anabinostat is currently in phase 3 studies. It is a more potent drug, and some initial phase 2 data presented at the ASCO meeting this year showed that in a bortezomib and dex refractory population that the three-drug combination re-engendered responses in about a third of patients. That, I think, seems a little more convincing than the data with avoralstat. However, we do need to wait for the phase 3 trials to make any conclusive comments. And there are other drugs certainly in development that are looking exciting. They're somewhat earlier in their development. Some of these are actually more monoclonal antibodies. And monoclonal antibody to the antigen CD138 is something that has shown daratumumab pretty impressive activity in phase 1 trial, which has made other pharmaceutical companies that have monoclonal antibodies to this target accelerate their development. So that may be another space to watch out for. I think that there are certainly other drugs, including monoclonal antibodies to CD56, among others, that seem to have in earlier development hints of activity. So I think that this is something that will continue to pay dividends in the years to come. I think I'll be glad to take further questions.
Okay. So, I mean, Dr. Vaid, that was a comprehensive assessment of what's happening in this landscape, and it looks like carfilzomib would be a pretty exciting drug should they be able to understand why it's causing the side effects of shortness of breath and what's the exact cause of it. And then the last, the histone, the drugs that are working with the histone metabolism pathway, penobenostat, benostat, you know, I mean, these are all cutting edge drugs, and the monoclonal antibodies that are targeting CD56 and the other targets on cell markers. So that would be very, that definitely looks like we have a pipeline that's looking forward 3 to 5 years. And I will let the panelists come back. I'm sure there will be questions by the panelists, by Pat and other people on carfilzomib and other drugs. So I will come back to these drugs that you mentioned. But we'll move on to the next question for you, and that is, as a myeloma patient, what are the 3 or 4 exciting clinical trials that are currently underway that people could be interested in, whether there are refractory patients or newly diagnosed patients? Some of the clinical trials that you may want to talk about and inform our listeners so that they keep a tab on, either what they want to participate in them or try these trials, the endpoints of which could change or prove that certain drugs, how they're working, and then that effectively change the outcome of how treatment will be delivered in the next 3 to 5 years. So can you provide us some insight into some of these trials that are going on and which are the ones that we should be keeping a tab on going forward for the next few months to a couple of years?
So I think that certainly clinical trial enrollment is very much something that should be encouraged irrespective of, compound. I think in the appropriate space, I wouldn't say that there's only 1 or 2 or 3 compounds that one should be excited about. Some compounds are so early in their development that it is something that sometimes surprises us when we see the results. However, having said that, certainly the 3 drugs that one has already mentioned have ongoing clinical trials that would hopefully improve upon the results we're already seeing. With carfilzomib, different institutions have a variety of trials that are ongoing. I think that as I said, some of these are looking at higher doses of drugs. Others are looking at drug combinations. There are trials with carfilzomib that are due to be launched looking at it as a sensitizing agent in stem cell transplant, as maintenance therapy post-stem cell transplant. There are additional trials that are ongoing looking at the drug in upfront therapy. There's going to be possibly a study starting that will combine the drug with melphalan and prednisone and compare it to Velcade, melphalan, and prednisone, which may be a trial that will give us perhaps a new standard of care and lead to the licensing of carfilzomib for upfront use. The drug is something that is being looked at in certainly other settings as well. So I think that that is a compound that will certainly you know, people can hopefully avail of, not only commercially, but add to the science and to the options for future patients as well by participating in a clinical trial. Trials with pomalidomide are also ongoing. People are combining the drug with Velcade and dexamethasone, combining it with carfilzomib and dexamethasone, and certainly additional combination therapies in the relapsed refractory setting. So I think that there's going to be a compassionate use trial that will make the drug available for people going forth that can avail of the drug till the drug hopefully gets licensed next year. So that's, you know, going to open, I believe, at a number of centers. Elotuzumab, as I said, is also being studied in a number of trials, both in combination with lenalidomide and dexamethasone in upfront and relapse refractory setting, as I said, the Eloquent 1 and 2 trials, but also in combination with Velcade, and there are certainly plans to study it in combination with our newer agents going forth, like pomalidomide and carfilzomib. And so the paradigm in myeloma has been to combine more and more agents to get deeper responses and hopefully increase the chances of, you know, some kind of more long-sustained remission. So I think that three drug combinations have kind of become a de facto kind of standard, like Velcade, Revlimid, Decadron, or Velcade, Cytoxan, Dexamethasone, to name a couple. Going forth, there may be times when four drug combinations may be something that may be appropriate, but I think that it is something that we still need to prove that, you know, four drugs are off study, something that everybody should be getting. I think that trying to deepen the responses by combining our current modalities of therapies, the new agents with stem cell transplantation, remains a very logical way to improve upon the results that we are seeing. So I think that in the past some debate has been, well, is transplant something that is no longer necessary? And I am hopeful that it will no longer be necessary within my lifetime. However, I think some of the best results that are seen still are when you kind of use all the therapies in your armamentarium rationally and in some kind of sequence rather than choosing between them, just sequence them. And I think that hopefully we will continue to see better results with that. And one day, hopefully, we can do it without the transplant. But I think most people would agree that transplant remains in the paradigm for patients who are transplant eligible.
Mm-hmm. So definitely, you know, lots of options for patients out there. And we are in, at the halfway mark of the conversation and the CURE panel now, Dr. Vij. And I will now open it up to our panelists. I do have a few, a couple of more questions, which we'll try to get back to towards the end of the call. But I would like to now invite the panelists one by one to have a conversation with you. And they can, they'll pick up a topic of interest, or they can even just follow up with some of the discussion that we've had about the latest drugs that are in the pipeline, the clinical trials that are looking at combination of different drugs and trying to make a headway into providing better treatment options for patients. So we're going to start with Pat Killingsworth. And Pat, we're going to get you on air and love to have you have a quick discussion with Dr. Vij about a topic of interest. Pat, please introduce yourself and take it from there.
Hi, this is Pat, Doctor. It's great to get a chance to talk with you. Traditionally, a newly diagnosed patient is given basically as high a dose as chemotherapy as somebody thinks they can possibly stand, and then adjustments are made as time goes on and the doses drop. And I wondered if we're making progress understanding what the optimal dosing might be for individual patients and how that might improve their quality of life sometimes by the time you get the dose that works and also doesn't practically kill the patient. You know, that can take months and months, and it can be very difficult. Are we making some progress in that way?
Well, certainly. I think that obviously the most intensive therapy is what is delivered in the context of a stem cell transplant. That does put patients through several days of misery in the hospital and a few weeks of recuperation. I think that the benefits most people think are still worth the short-term decline in functional capacity, because most studies suggest, as I said, about a two-year extra lifespan if one goes through that short-lived misery. But I think our newer drugs are testament to the fact that we are actually making progress in dose de-escalation. I think that our newer generation of drugs, proteasome inhibitors and immunomodulatory drugs, are something that are better tolerated, certainly, than stem cell transplant, and certainly also better than some of the more aggressive chemotherapy regimens that we used to have in the past. I think that the toxic effects on the bone marrow certainly are less. The individual drugs have their slightly different profiles, and tolerability is also something that differs by individual and by the age of the patient. In older individuals, we tend to use drugs at a lower dose to balance the efficacy side effect profile. But I think that with bortezomib, you saw that the effort to dose reduce the intensity did, in the context of at least three or four drug regimens, seem to still maintain efficacy and reduce toxicity. And the subcutaneous administration of the drug, I think, in most cases has led to better tolerability of the drug. So I think, yes, we are continuing our efforts to give drugs in a better tolerated manner, be it by dose de-escalation or by changing the route of administration or making other maneuvers.
Thank you.
So, Pat, do you have any follow-up questions in regards to some of the drugs that Dr. Ridge mentioned, like carfilzomib or thymolidomide or some of the other drugs that you just had a discussion about? We still have a couple of minutes for you to ask any follow-up questions in regards to those, that information.
Well, I just thought it was important and interesting that he brought up the dexamethasone and how important it is that it be combined with, I guess, all of these drugs to help them work better. And for example, Dr. Dexamethasone would be an example of what I was talking about. Do we really know for sure? I mean, so many patients have adverse reactions to dex, and, you know, demon dex it's called, and it's sort of hated, although if it keeps us alive, I suppose we should love it. It may not be fair, but are we sure 40 milligrams, for example, is necessary a week? And if it is, I notice that most doctors don't care how you take it. Like they'll say, but you can take the 40 milligrams all at once, or you can take two, you know, 4 milligram pills a day for the week, or whatever it is. Do we know when it's best to take the dexamethasone, and do you really need to use 40 milligrams in order to get the benefit? Could it be 20, for example?
Yeah, so I
I
empathize, and I agree that sometimes the dexamethasone is the worst in terms of our treatment options for tolerability. People sometimes say, we don't have any problem with aggressive chemotherapy, but the dex, that we just can't stand. And I think that, yes, the drug is a very active drug in the treatment of myeloma. People have looked at trying to eliminate it from certain regimens, and there are certain regimens wherein the dex is not there, like Velcade with Doxil was touted as a steroid-free regimen. And I think that as to the dose of the drug, I don't think anybody has really got much, you know, to support the contention that a certain dose level is better or worse than the other, and whether giving the drug in a more concentrated fashion on a single day or spread out to perhaps reduce some of the side effects at lower doses, whether, you know, there's one particular maneuver that is more or less efficacious. I think that, unfortunately, there are so many questions to answer in myeloma with the newer drugs that efforts are targeted to accrue patients to those newer drug trials and certain more mundane and day-to-day issues that are perhaps of certainly greater relevance get consigned to the back burner, and you don't answer the questions that what is the right dose of dex, because that may take several hundred patients if you were to try to give a few different dosing regimens of dex. And the fact is that those patients may want to go on to trials with a newer drug, rather.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
So this is something, Pat, thanks for bringing it up. This has also been brought up by another panelist who will be coming on air, Karen, and I'll let her add to this discussion at that point. We'll move on to our next panelist, Laurie here, Dr. Ridge, and Laurie, we're going to get you on air to discuss your questions with Dr. Ridge, and then we'll get back to the discussion on dexamethasone as Karen comes on air later. Laurie, are we going to take you on air now?
Okay, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
My name is Laurie Puente. I live in California, and I'm a caregiver to my husband, Dave. And I just wanted to ask you, given that patients very quickly become concerned with the relapse scenario, even as they're getting treated as front, with their frontline therapy and in remission. So I'm curious as to what your plan B generally is when you have a patient that's facing relapse. And then also I'm curious as to what your thoughts are on the maintenance therapy that is so common now.
So I think that, again, I can't say there's one answer that fits all for what's the best option for a patient for relapse refractory disease. It depends on a number of factors, depends on what drugs they received, what drugs they have tolerated well in the past, what the age of the patient is, what other issues like the patient's general health, performance status, or critical organ function is. And what we do know is, at least to date, the two drugs that have formed the backbone of therapy for the last decade have been bortezomib and lenalidomide, often given in sequence, but sometimes in combination for relapse refractory disease. And I think that if you get a panelist of 10 myeloma experts, there will be 10 different opinions on what really is the appropriate therapy. There will certainly be some consensus, but I just want to bring out that some of these things are genuinely unknowns, and I may give a certain opinion which I don't want people to think is dogma, because somebody else may tell you, well, that's not the way I think it should be done. So I think that this is something that is going to get even more challenging as we have more options available for patients. You know, maybe in 6 months we'll have, you know, to choose between Velcade, carfilzomib, lenalidomide, and pomalidomide, and how to sequence them. That, I think, is something that only time will tell as to how things will settle, but I don't think that we can have one strategy fits all. As to the regards to the question of maintenance, I think that's certainly the way the prevalent thought process is flowing in myeloma. That myeloma being a chronic disease, that it makes rational sense to have patients on some kind of maintenance therapy long-term to suppress the myeloma, to prevent it from coming back. I think that this strategy has been supported by the study that was done by the cooperative group known as the CLGB in the post-transplant setting, wherein they showed that patients not only take longer to progress, but they also live longer if they have got lenalidomide maintenance post-transplant. There are, however, other trials like the French trial that haven't yet reached that same conclusion. So I think that though most individuals, including myself, are using some kind of maintenance in either all or some select patients, depending on their individual strategy, either long-term or for a finite period of whatever, 2-3 years, most people are using some kind of maintenance with lenalidomide. In that regard, I think it is also important to note that data with bortezomib maintenance also exists from a recent publication that showed that it is perhaps a drug that really helps people who have adverse chromosomal features, have renal insufficiency, and I think that some people are either using that drug in preference to lenalidomide or in addition to lenalidomide in what we call cytogenetically high-risk groups. This is something that is convenient to give than it was in the past because the regimen, at least in the post-transplant setting, has been one dose to be given under the skin every 2 weeks rather than the full dose, which is twice weekly for 2 weeks and a week off. And giving it under the skin, coming to the doctor's office, you know, twice a month, is something that a lot of patients are willing to do, and it is something that I think is probably going to grow the use of proteasome inhibitors as maintenance therapy. Now, as in the post-conventional therapy phase, that is not in patients who have had a transplant, when induction ends and when maintenance begins is also somewhat of a question of what your definitions are. I think that often if you're giving two or three drug regimens and you drop one or two of the drugs after a period of time and give the other drug in a more extended manner, and I think that that paradigm has been certainly more with, again, lenalidomide maintenance, which is a more convenient thing to do for a patient to take pills at home rather than come to the doctor's office. With, however, bortezomib too, in the main post non-transplant maintenance setting, there is a push to give the drug for more extended periods of time instead of the 4 to 6 months, perhaps a year or more, if well tolerated. But I think that there could be some people who may argue that maintenance for everybody is perhaps not needed. And once again, 10 different people, you get some 10 different answers on this question.
That seems to be the successful myeloma. One question that I have that wasn't on my list is, what is your opinion about the extended use of bisphosphonates?
So, again, that's a very valid question as to what the appropriate duration and frequency of bisphosphonate use should be. When they were initially approved and shown to be beneficial, it was meant to be given as long as patients were tolerating it. The data that emerged over the last decade of what we call osteonecrosis of the jaw seemed to temper you know, that kind of enthusiasm, because the longer you remain on a bisphosphonate, the more likely you were to have this somewhat really debilitating, in some cases, problems with your jaw. So the current guidelines, at least from the American Society of Clinical Oncology and other guideline authorities, generally recommend the drug be given for monthly for a couple of years post-diagnosis, at which time, if the disease is inactive, the drug be discontinued. Now, people, again, have molded those guidelines to their independent practices. Some people, given the fact that the drug has got a very long half-life, and feel that even in the first couple of years, you may not need to give the drug monthly, that every 2 months or every 3 months administration of the drug may suffice. As you may know, in patients with postmenopausal osteoporosis, the drug is given just once a year, and that seems to be sufficient, at least in that condition. Now, with data that emerged from a British trial, the what we call the MRC9 trial, there seemed to be suggestion that bisphosphonates not only improve bone health, but perhaps extend life. Now, one thing is that this data is limited to a subset analysis of a single trial, so there is still some skepticism about whether that is truly a benefit from the drug. And what we also don't know is that do you need to give it long-term to get that benefit? But some people have, keeping that piece of data in mind, modified their practice, and instead of stopping at 2 years, perhaps giving the drug every 2 to 3 months on a more long-term basis, trying to balance the toxicity and the efficacy profile of the drug. But like in most cases, the right answer is not known.
That was a great question, Laurie. Thanks for bringing up the discussion on bisphosphonates, and Dr. Wedge for your response. Laurie, we'll move on to the next panelist as we are running out of time, but thanks for those excellent questions. We have Nick as our next panelist. Nick, if you are there, could you kindly press 1 so that we can get you on air? We'll try to get Nick. We have not been able to identify his phone number from which he is calling, so we're trying to get him on air.
Hi, I've been pressing 1. Any luck?
Yeah, I guess we can hear you now.
Excellent.
So, Nick, please go ahead and we'll have a conversation with Dr. Ridge about your topic of interest.
Hello, everyone. This is almost like a family reunion since all of us bloggers sort of know each other, so it's nice to hear some familiar voices. I am one of those, Dr. Vidge, who is enrolled in a trial that will hopefully prove that autologous transplants can lead to a cure. I've been in the care of Dr. Barlagi for the last 3.5 years and have gone through a tandem transplant, and I'm now concluding 3 years of what most people would consider to be very aggressive maintenance therapy with a high dose of Velcade weekly plus daily Revlimid and weekly Dex. And my question relates, and I apologize for you not getting this in advance, to the long-term use of Revlimid in maintenance, because I know one thing that Dr. Barley and others are looking at is almost, perhaps, indefinite use of some reduced dose of Revlimid to keep killing any cells that didn't get with the original program. Given the linkage that seems to be emerging between Revlimid and myelodysplastic syndrome, do you think, particularly for younger patients, that that's going to influence the direction of maintenance with this drug?
Well, a lot of good questions in there. So I think that as far as the duration of maintenance goes, as I had alluded to, I think earlier in my monologue there, I think right duration of therapy is not known. Certainly the trial that showed that the drug improved survival, the CLGB study, gave it for till time of progression or patients not able to tolerate it. So it was an open-ended lenalidomide study. The current studies that are ongoing, for most part, give it for a more limited period of 2 to 3 years. The right answer as to whether a finite period of treatment or an open-ended period of treatment is the right approach, I think, is not known, though some people harbor very strong views that you do need to give the drug long-term, and that giving the drug for a finite period of time is not the right approach. I personally kind of have a little difficulty totally endorsing the open-ended commitment in the absence of any data to suggest that. But in the context of a clinical trial especially, I think it is absolutely an appropriate thing to do. As regards the issue of secondary malignancies and myelodysplastic syndromes in patients with myeloma, I think that that is an issue that certainly seems to be there in patients who have had what we call autologous transplants or alkylating agents, whether in the context of a transplant or not, and then get more long-term Revlimid. However, I think that data from all the trials that have been analyzed suggests that the benefits of the drug far outweigh the potential risk for MDS or other malignancies. Now, we also have to realize that there is a baseline excess risk of other cancers in patients with myeloma that has been described. And so I think that, yes, the randomized trial showed, despite that, that it seems that in 3 trials, that at least, there is an excess of secondary cancers of a wide variety of different cancers, not just MDS, in patients who get lenalidomide maintenance. My own take on that is that the benefits of the drug far outweigh the risks, and that is something that I at least don't think is something that, at least with the level of data we have, a driving force in my decision to limit therapy to 2 or 3 years. I think that we have had cancer-causing chemotherapy drugs that we have used for well over several decades. It's an unfortunate consequence of our treatments, but in nearly every case, it has benefited more people than it has harmed. So I think that whereas in an individual one can't be sure, at least as a strategy for a group of patients or a population of patients, I don't think anybody at this time says that we should be limiting lenalidomide use driven by the second cancer risk. They may have independent opinions about limiting the therapy for other reasons, but I don't think cancer risk is a major one for most.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Nick, thanks for that wonderful question, actually. And we'll move on to our next panel. Nick, would you do you have any follow-up?
I yield to my colleague.
Because we are down to the last 8 minutes, and I'd like to bring on other people as soon as possible. So we'll get to Karen, who's going to be on air now. And Karen, I believe you had a question about dexamethasone as well, but please feel free to go ahead with your topic of discussion.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Actually, my first question, I'm one of the younger myeloma patients. I was diagnosed at 30. I'm 37 now. But it seems like through my blog, I've met more and more people in their 20s and 30s, and wondering, are there more younger myeloma patients now? And if so, is there a difference in the way that they're treated compared to the typical older myeloma patient?
Yes, so I think we've had that question that a lot of people have contemplated on, that are we seeing patients that are younger and more frequently now? And really, the analysis of the data suggests that that is not the case. The data actually suggests that for at least a population, that the age of diagnosis is actually creeping upwards. However, yes, myeloma in younger patients is a issue that we do encounter. The youngest patient that I have seen with myeloma was 18 years old. I think that the biology of the disease in younger people versus older individuals is something that I don't think at the moment is well studied. What we do know is, yes, younger people actually do better with treatments that they get than older individuals do, whether that's a reflection of the biology of the disease, is the overall general good health of the population when you're younger, is unclear. As to the paradigm of treatment for younger patients being different than older individuals, I think that for most part it is not. However, I think that the younger you are, the more likely that your physician will at least bring up the talk about an allogeneic transplant, which is an issue that we haven't discussed much about, because the data there is, I think, at the moment still not convincing that at least for a population of patients that that is the right thing to do. But younger patients are really the ones that are able to tolerate this kind of treatment better, and if they're willing to take the risk of potentially somewhat higher morbidity and mortality to attempt a cure, at least in that population, few people would have an ethical dilemma to offer it as a therapy. I think that there are 5 randomized trials of transplant, autologous versus allogeneic. Two of them have shown a survival advantage for allogeneic transplant. Two have not. One shows a trend perhaps towards better survival. And some people feel the negative trials may turn positive with longer follow-up, because most of the trials that are done in myeloma in the transplant setting, the curves of survival seem to diverge with longer follow-up. There is, however, another group of individuals in the thought leader community who think that we should actually give up studying allogeneic transplant, and that it is something that has, in their mind at least, been shown not to be benefiting patients. So I think that, like I've said in a number of times during this hour of conversation, the honest answer is not known, but if anything, for younger individuals, it's more likely that a physician may offer an allogeneic transplant option with curative intent.
Okay.
Thanks, Karen. And we now move on to Gary, who's the editor of the Myeloma Survival blog. And Gary, you're on air now, and you have a few minutes to discuss your topic with Dr. Vidge. Please introduce yourself as well.
Yes. First of all, Dr. Vidge, I do thank you for giving your time and energy to this effort, because I think, you know, the education of the myeloma patient community is utmost in helping, you know, them to understand, or us to understand, shall we say, what's available to us as patients. And secondly, for Cure Talk, for putting this on to begin with. And like Nick said, it is kind of old folks week, you know, because we've seen each other and we've read each other's blog. And I have the utmost of respect for everybody, Pat, Karen, and Nick, and Lori. So with that, let me ask you this question, Dr. Vij. How do you define high risk, the high-risk patient, and how would you treat a low-risk versus a high-risk patient?
That's a great question. So I think that most people define high-risk based on cytogenetics. Some go with the gene expression profiling that is available commercially now in addition to the cytogenetic profiling. And the definition, at least based on cytogenetics, has sort of shifted over the last couple of years. What was thought to be two risk groups, high risk and low risk, have now, at least by some, proposed to be split into three risk groups, high, low, and intermediate. And I think that the major change that has occurred is perhaps in some people's minds that deletion 13 by chromosomal analysis and 414 translocation by FISH analysis, the adverse impact perhaps is overcome by the use of proteasome inhibitors, and therefore they've moved from a high-risk group to an intermediate risk group. And I think that what people still feel is a major unmet medical need is what we call P53 deletion or 17p deletion, which is a tumor suppressor gene that gets enriched in a population as they get more and more therapies, and is something that really has defied our attempts to overcome. There was some intriguing data recently that bortezomib maintenance, at least post-transplant, may actually overcome that as well, but I think that most people still feel that that's a problem that we really haven't been able to get our hands around. I think that gene expression profiling certainly is also able to identify high-risk patients. The question, though, is that how does that translate into therapeutic decision-making? Most of the data in that respect comes from the group at Arkansas. I think that others are starting to validate that, but it is something that is not often even obtained, though commercially available and reimbursable by Medicare, because we don't know often, I think, what to do with that data set. Some people would add renal insufficiency to the high-risk group because, unfortunately, people who present with kidney problems, kidney failure, do worse overall than those that have mild to normal kidney function at diagnosis. However,
that was
me. With the modern drugs, we're able to reverse the kidney dysfunction in a greater proportion of patients. There, the key is to actually get the disease under control as fast as you can. And paradoxically, though, these patients are often the sicker ones. Giving them certainly three-drug combinations, even if you are a believer in only two-drug combinations, makes rational sense, because if you can reverse the renal failure within a period of 2 months post-diagnosis, those patients, at least in retrospective research, seem to do as well as people who started with normal kidney function. But if the kidney function doesn't reverse, then unfortunately still, those people don't do as well, and that constitutes a poor risk group in several people's minds. And then I think extramedullary disease, which is becoming more common, that as you fail multiple therapies, the disease leaves the bone marrow and starts growing in soft tissue areas under the skin, in certain cases, the liver, the lung, the spleen may be involved, and those patients are challenging. Certainly when you develop plasma cell leukemia, that's a more challenging population as well. And there are certainly other risk stratification factors, including stage of the disease, certain factors like plasma cell labeling index, high CRP, that people, and high LDH is another one that even in the era of modern prognostic, molecular prognostic systems, seems to hold up. People who have a high LDH have got, unfortunately, not as good an outcome as people with normal LDH. So I think that we have a lot of prognostic markers. The real challenge is how to tailor therapies to these prognostic markers, and that's, I think, the challenge that hopefully will be met in the decade to come.
Actually, it looks like we have run out of time, and the Blog Talk Radio is bringing the call and the talk to a close. Gary, can you still hear us and other folks?
Yeah.
We're trying to bring on the last two panelists, though we're not. Kim and Jennifer, if you're there, please press one, and hopefully you'll be added to the conversation, because the system is saying the call is coming to an end. Dr. Wade, we'll try to bring on Kim and Jennifer to wrap up the conversation, but if they're not there, we will definitely bring them on in a follow-up panel. But Kim and Jennifer, can you press one and try to get on air? I believe we have lost them on the call in the last couple of minutes. But Dr. Wade, thank you so much for taking the time out for joining us on the panel. I think it's been a wonderful.
I guess we got cut off. Thank you. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, and all the panelists, Gary, Pat, Nick, Laurie, Karen, Jennifer, Kimberly, we couldn't get to you, but thanks a lot for joining us and all the listeners. We will send a detailed wrap-up of this and post it on the blog and individually mail to everybody. Thank you so much for making the inaugural CURE panel a success, and we will be hosting another one very shortly.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
All right, bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.
for you can know something not in service. You feel you can keep that error, please hang up and try your point.
ऑनलाइन दिखा रहा था